This episode is sponsored by World History Encyclopedia, one of the top history websites on the internet. I love the fact they're not a wiki. Every article they publish is reviewed by the editorial team, not only for being accurate, but also for being interesting to read. The website is run as a non-profit organization, so you won't be bombarded by annoying ads, and it's completely free. It's a great site, and don't just take my word for it. They've been recommended by many academic institutions, including Oxford University. Go check them out at worldhistory.org or follow the link in the episode description. On the 16th of February, 2024, Russian politician Alexei Navalny died in an Arctic penal colony.
Mr. Speaker, the whole House will join me in sending our deepest condolences to the family of Alexei Navalny. He died for a cause to which he dedicated his whole life, freedom.
While the news was shocking to the world, it wasn't, sadly, surprising, as US President Joe Biden explained.
Putin had him poisoned, he had him arrested, he had him prosecuted for fabricated crimes, he sentenced him to prison. He was held in isolation. Even all that didn't stop him from calling out Putin's lies. Even in prison, he was a powerful voice for the truth.
Upon Navalny's death, foreign critics were quick to point the finger of blame at Vladimir Putin, and with good reason.
A third Russian man is facing charges over his alleged involvement in the Salisbury poisonings 3 years ago, which left one woman dead and three others critically ill.
In the last hour, it's been confirmed that Yevgeny Prigozhin, head of the Wagner Group, was on board the private jet that crashed near Moscow.
Now, there is unequivocal proof that the Russian opposition politician, Alexei Navalny, was poisoned with a Novichok nerve agent. That is the finding of the German government, which says that Mr. Navalny was the victim of attempted murder.
In this episode, I speak to an expert on Russia and Putin, David Satter, formerly the Moscow correspondent for the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal's special correspondent in the Soviet Union. David himself, as a journalist, fell foul of Putin's regime in 2013 when he was extraordinarily expelled from Russia. The cause of the problem, seemingly, is investigative reporting, which among other things had exposed FSB connections to the 1999 Moscow apartment bombings, which ultimately helped Putin to secure power. David, when Navalny passed away, immediately there was an assumption, probably by most people, that it was an assassination. And frankly, within the last year, it's terrible to say, but aside from the death of Prigozhin, who led the armed revolt against Putin, it was probably one of the least surprising political stories to come out of Russia. Obviously, the Russian government have claimed he died from natural causes. We've also heard some suggestions, even from within Ukraine, that perhaps he died of a blood clot, as opposed to some obvious, you know, poisoning with polonium, like some of the other dissidents. I think everyone would agree that in all likelihood, if Navalny wasn't in an Arctic penal colony, had access to medicine, doctors, good food, and so forth, he'd still be alive now. The question, though, is whether he was actively killed or if he died as a consequence of the treatment he was subjected to by Putin's regime. What are your thoughts on this?
I think that Putin is, and the regime are responsible for his death. How they chose to carry that out is something that can be determined by experts. Putin has killed all of his other opponents. Why would he leave Navalny under conditions of war in which people are being killed right and left? My take on it is that if it was blood clot or there was a heart attack or something like that, it was because of the conditions in which Navalny was placed, and the authorities were well aware that sooner or later such an event would take place. But it's more likely, I suppose, that they just decided to murder him. That would be typical for them. It's consistent with the way in which they behave normally. And we've seen the fate of other opponents of the regime. So there's little reason to believe that Navalny's fate would be different.
Skeptics and Putin apologists might argue that Navalny was already in prison. So why kill him now versus 6 months ago or 6 months in the future?
I think it's more a question of them just wanting to eliminate somebody who was an irritant, who was capable of calling attention to themselves, and in the long run, rallying opposition. They are oriented now towards stamping out opposition, and Navalny was the most important opposition figure in the country. He went back to Russia after the unsuccessful attempt to poison him. It was clear to many people that only a miracle would save his life.
Since the war in Ukraine began, Putin has passed a series of measures where pretty much any kind of criticism of government is somehow unpatriotic, and people risk 10-year prison sentences and worse for any kind of dissent. When Navalny's funeral occurred, we saw tens of thousands of people going there to attend it. Does that suggest that despite these measures, Putin doesn't have as much control as he thinks he does? Or does it show us that in actual fact he does? And had it not been for all these measures and these threats and punishments, that perhaps there would have been hundreds of thousands of people at Navalny's funeral. And now the tens of thousands is a sign that what Putin's trying to do is actually working.
Well, but tens of thousands of people who dared to show up, whereas we don't know how many people sympathize with them. No, it shows that there is dissent in the society. For the most part, those people who are against the war and against the regime are very fearful of expressing it. And they have reason for that, because for the slightest unauthorized remark, they can end up in jail. But Putin is holding on to the situation now. The level of fear is very high. And there's no reason to believe, particularly, that a massive revolt is imminent. We won't know until it actually happens. It's important to bear in mind that in the case of Prigozhin, no one predicted that he would end up taking such dramatic action until it actually began.
Fighting has now broken out between Wagner mercenaries and the Russian military in Voronezh. Vladimir Putin says Russia is facing a battle for its future in the face of an armed mutiny in the country. The president has accused the group of treason and has signed a law permitting 30-day detentions for breaking martial law in places where it's been imposed.
Like you, I should imagine, I read the Russian news quite a bit, realizing that it's heavily censored, just so I can kind of get a perspective on the view from within the country. And the extraordinary thing is that it's only about 9 months ago that Putin seemed in peril when Prigozhin and the Wagner group launched a revolt against him, shot down a plane, and marched on Moscow. Here in the US, we still have ongoing hearings about the January 6th insurrection. But this was something on a much bigger, much more dangerous scale. And yet it seems to have disappeared from the Russian narrative.
Well, for one thing, of course, his ability to suppress that revolt and to kill Prigozhin is dissuasive for those who would dream of following Prigozhin's example. And Prigozhin was in a unique position because he was the head of the most capable fighting units in the Russian military. Whether anyone else will be in a similar position remains to be seen. But Prigozhin had become a very popular political figure. He was making all kinds of public statements. He had rallied a certain element of the society around him. It's not clear that that can be easily duplicated. What we might see, though, is in the event of Ukrainian victories, an overall breakdown in military discipline. And under those circumstances, a dissident military leader could emerge. But the pattern with Prigozhin, in which a military leader made public statements, challenged the authorities, demanded changes in personnel, and then led a 450-mile march on Moscow, it's a little hard to imagine that being duplicated. We'd more likely see something emerging from the collapse of the front.
When this violent revolt unfolded, we saw scenes of Russian citizens seemingly cheering on the Wagner group. And when Prigozhin was killed, we saw interviews and we read things online from Wagner fighters saying, you know, we will avenge him and so on and so forth. All of that seems to have died away. Why is that?
He's certainly in control unless the situation at the front begins to break down, unless units begin to mutiny, unless armies refuse to carry out insane orders to attack. Under those circumstances, unrest could certainly spread. I mean, there are flickers of unrest in various of the ethnic areas, the ethnic national areas. There's also a movement of Russian women who are demanding the return of their husbands. Those movements have to be suppressed with caution. They don't openly oppose the Putin regime, but they nonetheless make demands that are destabilizing for the Putin regime. Overall, there has to be a situation in which the fear and the inertia that are holding Russia's institutions together begins to be broken in specific places. And as a result, an opening is created for an opposition leader.
Outside of Prigozhin, Kadyrov, the leader of Chechnya, is another warlord type whose troops have been active in Chechnya. He's been very outspoken about the war, kind of a hawk. He was also critical, obviously, of Prigozhin. Is he a danger to Putin in terms of his status as a military leader who has his own militia? And, you know, obviously Chechnya has a history of rebelling against Russia.
Still, you know, the numbers are still dwarfed by the numbers of people in the Russian army, and he depends on Putin for support. His legion could become very important if there's general chaos, because they're disciplined and they're loyal to him. I mean, Kadyrov. There are forces in Chechnya that resent the Republic's ties with Russia and resent Kadyrov's role as a kind of Russian puppet, albeit one with a great deal of autonomy. If Russia is weakened, or if Russia's support for Kadyrov is weakened, they could take the risk of political action themselves. But for the moment, Kadyrov is in charge and so is Putin. Those are mutually reinforcing propositions. If Putin's position becomes insecure, Kadyrov's position might become insecure also.
There was a time not so long ago when, due to term limits, Putin stepped down from being president and a guy called Medvedev stepped in and even had the bravery to criticize Putin for unacceptable comments. And at the time, Medvedev was viewed as much more liberal and progressive than Putin. Recently, though, Medvedev has sort of reappeared on the scene as one of the most hawkish figures here, talking about nuclear wars, talking about bombing Britain, bombing France. What happened to change Medvedev? Was he actually a liberal? Now he's not? Or is he just some malleable lackey who is just doing what Putin tells him to?
He's malleable, of course, as are the other people in the regime. What he's saying is what he's being told to say. They have a whole graduated hierarchy of people who are authorized to make threats. And the level of the threat doesn't necessarily represent a genuine opinion, but it's intended as a weapon of war to destabilize the West and undermine our determination. Medvedev seemed to be moderate at one point, but that too was a play. He played the role of the moderate in the regime. Now he's playing a different role. If he's told to, he'll play a third role. That's the way it is with Russian officials.
Since the invasion of Ukraine occurred, we've heard from Russia various red lines that if the West crosses them, will result in Russia using nuclear weapons. Various red lines have included missiles like the HIMARS, F-16 planes, and attacks on territory that was originally Russian, aside from the territory they now claim. All of those red lines, as it were, have been crossed, and we haven't seen nuclear weapons used. So do the Russians have a credibility problem now, in the way that Obama famously did with his red line on chemical weapons in Syria that were then used and yet Assad stayed in power.
Various people are saying this, including television personalities who have no authority. It shakes up people in the West. It generates headlines, which it's intended to do, but it doesn't mean that it's part of a serious plan. I mean, this is part of the way in which they keep the West off balance, and they mitigate the movement in the West. They reduce the movement in the West to give Ukraine fully meaningful assistance.
So building on that question, do you think there is a possibility at some point Russia may use nuclear weapons in this conflict?
I don't think that strategic weapons are likely to be used. In other words, those weapons that could hit the United States. Because, I mean, after all, that would provoke a strategic response. Tactical weapons, if the regime thought they could gain an advantage from them, and if their back was to the wall, and if Putin's hold on power were threatened, there's a possibility that they would be used. They might be. You know, it's hard to say. You see, the scenarios are unpredictable, including a scenario in which the use of tactical nuclear weapons, however devastating, would actually be beneficial to the Russian cause. I mean, it'd kill a lot of people, that's for sure. But would it really result in victory for them or bring them closer to victory? The forces are pretty close to each other, for one thing. And a nuclear explosion would affect people on both sides. At the same time, it would change the world configuration because countries which had given Russia their tacit support might not do so in the event of the use of such a weapon because they don't want those weapons used on them in their local disputes. And finally, it would, of course, enrage the Ukrainians to such a degree that Russia would never reconcile with the Ukrainian people. Mm-hmm. So for all those reasons, the resort to nuclear weapons is not obvious, but we can't rule it out because of the moral level of the people who are in charge in Russia.
There was an interesting documentary last year talking about how Russia has a falling population, but it's particularly dropping in the eastern part of the country. And as a consequence of this, they're allowing huge numbers of Chinese businessmen, entrepreneurs, and regular citizens to come across the border in areas like Vladivostok and Siberia. Just a couple of weeks ago, there was an article exposing Russian Secret Service fears about China perhaps eyeing up Siberia as territory they may try and take at some point, and Russia responding by moving more assets to that area. Do you think that is something that Putin is concerned about, despite the appearance of this friendship without limits that he seemingly has with Xi Jinping?
Yeah, of course there is, because, I mean, and especially, but given the logic of the Russian invasion and the claim that these are traditional Russian lands, well, the Chinese claim large parts of Russia as traditional Chinese lands. The Japanese claim, you know, the islands in the Kirill chain that were annexed by the Soviet Union, by Stalin, they want those back. Right now, the Chinese find it to their advantage to aid Russia to a certain degree. Not clear that they would do so if the West made it obvious that continued support for Russia jeopardizes commercial relations. We haven't done that, but we could.
This time last year, there was a lot of talk in the Western media about this Ukrainian spring offensive to retake territory taken by Russia. Much talk about all the weapons and money given. But as it turned out, we really didn't see any kind of spectacular moves by the Ukrainians recapturing territory. And in actual fact, in the last few months, it appears that Russia is actually the one moving across the front line. Do you think now Russia is actually in control in this battle and more likely to move further into Ukraine than Ukraine is to actually fight back?
They're going to need American weapons. And as we know, the U.S. has held up the delivery of weapons to Ukraine. This is a crucial factor. They're outnumbered. They need modern weapons to compensate for that. How bad the situation is on the battlefield, I don't know. But I do think this, that we should be wary of overestimating or underestimating the strength of the Ukrainian army. We had a tendency to overestimate it when they were doing very well. We may be underestimating it now. There are other countries besides the US that are willing to give weapons to Ukraine, which is very welcome. But yeah, we'll just have to wait and see. This is a war that's not going to end easily. And for it to end at all, Ukraine is going to have to be in a stronger position than it is now. I don't think the Ukrainian authorities want to be dominated by Russia. They don't want to leave a large part of their territory and a large percentage of their people in Russian hands. This is perfectly understandable.
If you enjoy this podcast, and I have a ton of extraordinary content coming up over the next few months, please like, subscribe, or share on social media with your friends. It's the best way for independent podcasts like this one to compete with the multi-million dollar corporations. Fascinating people, fascinating places returns. I talk to Eric Maddox, the man responsible for capturing Saddam Hussein, attorney Jason Wright, whose career was rocked when he was tasked with defending September 11th mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. I speak with experts about human trafficking, the death of Princess Diana, the legacy of Scott of Antarctica. I talk with a TV celebrity who abandoned stardom for the simple life, chat with astronaut Jim Weatherby, and much, much more. Please subscribe so you don't miss out on any of the action.